So the organizers are certainly pleased that Van Wedeen from Harvard Medical School is here. He's one of the early guys working on phase contrast tracking and imaging, velocity imaging, phase velocity imaging. And he's doing some recent work, I believe, in DTI related to the heart. So he's going to talk to us about.
Does anybody know what that window is? Okay. So, I mean, if you say I've never done before, which is give a talk that kind of that really mixes heart and brain imaging liberally for reasons that may or may not become clear by the end of the hour. Let's see. Let me just show you a technology that you won't have seen before, just as a kind of background for this. This is a little picture of the fiber tracks in a rabbit brain. Done with a technique called diffusion spectrum imaging. Let's see, here's the cerebellum swinging around. This pin cushion is the cortex. This is the olfactory lobe. The red stuff is, let's see, this red stuff over here is the anterior commissure. What's, you see there's a little bit of horizontal structure in the cortex. That'll become important later. There is some hint of it. See the brain stem. Too much memory. Anyway, this is a tractography constructed from diffusion data, which is high resolution diffusion. High resolution diffusion makes it possible to see multiple fiber populations at each point. So keep this in mind, and now let's proceed to talk about the heart. So first we'll talk about some methods we have for looking at myocardial strain. Now, when we got into this, we thought that strain was the most important variable, and that choosing between strain and strain rate, strain rate offered many technical advantages, specifically that you could look at it with a phase contrast technique and set aside the confusion about the choice between Eulerian and Lagrangian coordinates. It's just basically a velocity mapping. When we started doing this, the only options were to do it two-dimensionally, and it soon became apparent that two-dimensional data could not be considered quantitative in any meaningful sense. There was too much being left out. You couldn't tell what was compressible and incompressible. You couldn't measure transverse shears. So we had to get to three-dimensional data. Just a little diagram of typical myocardial short axis deformation. So a method that we came up with our collaborator, David Feinberg, was to do echoplanar phase contrast imaging in which we take a picture of two contiguous slices in a single echoplanar shot. So what happens is you have a pulse sequence, radiant echo pulse sequence, where you excite one slice, then you put a little phase encode in it, and then you have a readout gradient. Then you excite the second slice. And what happens is the two slices refocus at different times. They produce, you have an early, in every readout of the EPI readout chain, you get an early echo and a late echo. So you get these images of two contiguous slices that are separated by a millisecond. And so they're really simultaneous. So now if you have a velocity phase encoding sitting across these two slices, you can compute all the strain components, the partials, including partials of x, derivatives in y, and in z in the slices, from data which is truly instantaneous. So here, for example, we built a phantom that is a bowl of jello. We push down on the jello. And here are phase contrast images of x, y, and z velocity components for the two contiguous slices. And then we do the usual calculation. One gets a deformation gradient tensor map, such as this. So this entire image is taken in four shots. You need x, y, z codes and a reference encode. So you have four shots. But critically, all of the partial, all of the spatial derivatives can be taken within data from each of those shots. You never have to look at a spatial derivative trials comparing data taken at different times. So there's no temporal incoherence introduced into the middle of your strain tensor. So you get very nice strain tensor. So I should say strain rate tensor, but obviously the two are somewhat interchangeable. So here's the deformation field of that ball of jello, three little three-dimensional strain rate tensors, or deformation gradient tensors. And here's a reconstruction of the deformation of the jello. Well, here's one slice of a normal human subject, and you see the three-dimensional cardiac strain field. The red direction signifies the elongating direction, the positive strain, and the blue and green are the contracting directions. And you see that the red is radial, all the little boxoids are pointing radially, and the blue-green directions have that nice twist. You see there's sort of like a spiral of dominoes in a circle indicating the transverse, the true portion of the ventricle, which is a longitudinal circumferential shear. So the next question is, how should one go about giving, well, we can look at data of this kind, and you know, it's enjoyable to do so. Here's an amusing color code for this data. Where is it? Light goes off. Is that enough of an explanation? Let's see. A very nice color code. So you have three eigenvalues for the tensor, and you can code the shape of the tensor by the skewness of the three eigenvalues, and so that becomes hue, and the speed of the deformation by the absolute sum of the eigenvalues, and so you get this nice color code. So it's nice with three, you know, just the pleasures of working with three-dimensional data. This is a systole-like pattern where one direction gets long and two directions gets short. This is a diastole-like pattern where one direction gets short and two directions get long. And they have completely inequivalent shapes associated with them reflected in the color code. So it's a very efficient, this color code is a very efficient way to look at data. Here's a nice normal cardiac cycle, seven slices and seven cardiac phases. I'm sorry, is that seven? Seven. So this is taken, and here, seven time points. This represents a 28 heartbeat acquisition. And so 28 heartbeats, you know, seven frames times four directions, 28 heartbeats. So that's a breath hold for just about anybody. You know, anybody can kind of hold their breath once for 28 heartbeats. You know, it takes that long for the CO2 to get around anywhere. You know, I mean, it's building up and then they're unhappy. You get this nice one. You have your two systolic frames, and then you have your diastolic frame, and you have your untwist frame. After so you have your rapid relaxation frame, and then you have this untwist frame where you have an intermediate tensor shape, where the tensor has one positive, one negative, and one zero direction, where the skewness is approximately zero. So it's a very information-rich set. Here, just high temporal resolution. Here, an individual with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and well, sure enough, it's a mess. But in more detail, it's a mess in interesting ways. You can see the thickened septum over here, and you can see intramurally in the septum during this untwist phase. Well, here's systole, so you see a nice transmural gradient of strains. But in untwist, there really emerge patches of very weird intramural dyskinesis during this phase. And of course, that is easy to rationalize in terms of the untwist is when there's very low stress levels in the wall, and so the wall is very easily expresses heterogeneity of material properties. You know, very little pressure, so it's either a spring or it's not a spring. And this one I really like, another HCM individual. And you have to look kind of closely at it. But if you look here in this, if you look here in this corner, you see an alternation. You look, these guys are green up, then they're blue up, then they're green up, then they're blue up. You see there are stripes. This is a buckling pattern. So this region here is getting crunched during systole. Parts of it are getting pushed up, and then the next part of it is getting pushed laterally. architecture. The problem with the problem with strain is how do you analyze it? You have this strain field, and then what coordinates do you put it in? As I learned in nuclear medicine, cardiac coordinates are great for normal subjects, but circumferential, radial, and longitudinal coordinates become increasingly impossible to define in people with bad heart disease. So, using canonical coordinates just is not a very attractive possibility. So, plan B, use the fiber architecture as a scaffold and reference system to express all cardiac strains. So, how to do it? Well, diffusion. So, as you know, it's an Institute for Pure Applied Mathematics. I couldn't resist this slide. This is from this one's from Thurston, but there's another one from Penrose's Twister letter. I don't know why the fiber architecture of the heart has this, what some physicists argue is the simplest shape in the universe. And I'd like someone to explain this to me. So that's why I put these slides up as a challenge. Why is this thing, why is the heart a unit quaternion? There must be a good explanation. I just don't happen to know what it is. But anyway, there's the unit quaternion. So, diffusion tensor imaging. Well, a diffusion tensor is capable of getting just this much and no more detail out of structure. You presume you have a fiber, fibers pointing in one direction, and then myocardial sheets, whatever they may be, pointing in a transverse direction, and that these will map onto the two leading eigenvectors of the diffusion tensor. And as you heard yesterday, and all know, this is pretty much the case. So here, for example, we have a little bit of the wall diffusion planes pointing along myocardial sheets. This is an in vivo study in which we this is a stimulated echo technique in which there are two gate triggers so that the diffusion encoding occurs at identical phases in two consecutive cardiac cycles, which is necessary to avoid phase effects in the data. But it's a standard diffusion tensor scan with six encoding directions, and you see here we have the tensors plotted. As these are actually ellipsoidal cylinders, but no matter. And you see the classic gradient transmural helix angle, the color code of the helix angle. You get something upwards of 180 degrees of helix angle rotation from every endocardium. The key analytic point is that if you want to use this stuff clinically, you have to have an easy way of telling normal from abnormal. And what I'm struck by is that when you look at the normal, the surface anatomy of the heart, it's all kind of lumpy and bumpy and irregular. But when you look inside the wall at the helix angle variation, it's extremely circularly symmetric in a normal case. And this, on the one hand, expresses the elegant logic of myocardial mechanics, but on the other hand, is analytically useful in differentiating a normal from an abnormal case. And notice also where the helix angles just march right through the trabeculae and papillary muscle structure. It's as if the helix angle architecture doesn't care that the inner wall has this fractal architecture. They just maintain their predicted variability. Yes?
The question is, everybody else puts the dead heart in a scanner for 6 hours and get this kind of information.
This isn't 200. This is running 10 minutes. So this is a 10-minute scan on a normal subject.
Still a lot more technically different.
Our voxels are bigger. So this is about a 3 millimeter, this is a 3x3x8 millimeter spatial resolution compared to some of the other images. This isn't a particularly good scan. In fact, the need to speed this up is critical, because if you look at those tracking images with the fibers on, you obviously need a three-dimensional stack. Getting one slice out is kind of a parlor trick. So how to get a stack in a reasonable amount of time? We're going to need to basically do multiplexing of multiple acquisitions concurrently, and I think we can get up to about 8 slices in a 10-minute period. That's kind of that I think is what's easy to justify with current ideas.
But Bill, mentioned any other presentation or fiber angle?
I think my problem is nobody believes it works. The only constraint that I'm aware of The concern is that the diffusion is really affected physically by the deformation of the myocardium during the intervening period. So, for example, if you were to take a drop of dimolecule and put it into a bowl of Jello, and then squish on the Jello, wait a while, and then let it relax, that dimolecule, the diffusion will have spread to an ellipsoidal shape because those points were really closer together during the diffusion period. Now, this is actually a very curious point, and it just to develop itself. So people would be reasonably concerned that are you seeing something which is contaminated in some way by strain? Now, the first point qualitatively is that the helical symmetry of this thing has no strain counterpart. So that's one reason it can't be an artifact. But the second reason it can't be an artifact is if you just look at the data. As the data come out of your scanner, you can look at the phase of the diffusion-weighted images and see whether there is enough phase variation in that image to cause magnitude loss. So you can easily reject images that might be contaminated by motion events. But this is, as I was saying about we have many parentheses now on the table. So one set of parentheses is the effective strain on diffusion is real, but one can compensate for it by imaging essentially in the mean configuration of the myocardium. So you go to mid systole at the approximate mean configuration, and as a first order, the effect can be eliminated. A second point is that you can calculate the effect. Another point is that, here's one that I'll comment on later, but it's now apropos. You could talk about the net effect of diffusion. Diffusion obviously is critical in order to get metabolites in and out of cells, that's physiologic role. The trace of the diffusion tensor is in a way a measure of the total effect of diffusion. If the strain and the diffusion are not parallel, the strain can actually enhance the total effect of diffusion in the tissue. So there is a way in which the fact that the myocardium is a dynamically deforming structure, that deformation actually facilitates the movement of metabolites. And in fact, it does so in a way which is coupled to sheet thickness.
You image your cellular mid-systole?
Correct.
Mid-systole. Is that tried during diastasis on the heart or the stable position?
That wouldn't work because what happens is if you image that, I'm sorry, that's it. No, that, okay, but then you'll have a big deformation effect because what will happen is...
So that's the silent period.
What?
That's the silent period in cardiac cycle. It's hardly any filling.
The velocity is not the problem. The problem is what is strain state of the myocardium during the intervening time when the diffusion mixing is occurring. So if you go to the diastasis, just like end systole, are extreme positions. Relative to diastasis, the systolic configuration is all in one direction. All of the strains you have, the heart is radially thickened on average. But the reason you want to be in mid-systole is because it spends effectively half the time radially thickened, half the time radially thin, and those two effects cancel. So it's the plus-minus effect. But if you're at an extreme condition, then everything is on one or the other side, and that's where you get into trouble. By the way, qualitatively, the effect doesn't matter. The big strain in the heart is radial, so it's only the transverse shear strain that will affect the appearance of the helix angles. So if your purpose is to measure helix angles, then that measurement is remarkably insensitive to when you image in the cardiac cycle. It's only really the embrication angle and components of that kind. It would also be the sheet angle. It would also be the quantity. But if you want helix angle, this is really independent of the phase of cardiac cycle. Anyway, yes?
Yeah, I just want to make sure I was understanding this. If you go on cylinders, there's going to be a representation of the orientation of the fibers. It looks as though there's a positive fiber angle on the endocardium and a negative on the endocardium.
That's correct. That's correct, and that's what we see. This is a short axis cut in a perspective view, but no, your conclusion is correct, and that's if you look at the helix angle, this is the color scale. So zero, blue is circumferential, mid blue. So circumferential occurs in the mid wall. The helix angle goes on one side of that in the epicardium, which is light blue down here somewhere, and in the other direction from circumferential as you march.
The question would be absolutely. been a mirror image.
Oh.
On the outside is just flipped around differently.
Oh, I get it.
Yeah.
Okay. You mean it's left-handed versus right? I'm sorry, I'm very dyslexic. I couldn't tell you. I'd say there's a 50%, 50-50 chance we got that right. This is off my computer. I can tell you I have no idea. Anyway, so in a hypertrophic situation, another facet of the tensor, of course, is that disarray produces a relative isotropy of diffusion among all the components. So here we have a hypertrophic cardiomyopathy individual, and you see here you see a mess of orientations, but here the color saturation codes the anisotropy of the diffusion tensor. So these white areas, these white patches, or paler patches, are areas where the anisotropy is reduced intramurally. Sheet orientation, not a great slide, but sheet orientation in the normal individual, but sheet orientation in the hypertrophic instance where it's highly disordered. So particularly the sheet orientation is much more strikingly disordered than the fiber orientation, the primary fiber orientation. So now to put the two together. Well, okay, yeah, I guess I can do it now that I showed that movie. I just wanted to get back to the movie. But I will. We've got a blackboard. Okay, so here we have, in this instance, diffusion and strain register beta were obtained in the same individual, one after the next. And of course, one can interpolate the strain components in fiber coordinates and come up with fiber, well, here we have just fiber, cross fiber, and radial shortening. So fiber is, you know, fiber, radial is, you know, pick a center point, and cross fiber is the thing perpendicular to fiber and radial. This kind of an expansion. Or you can look at the fiber sheet normal expansion of the strain components. And here you begin to see that the fiber shortening, of course, is both negative, but second of all, is the most uniform of the terms, which is a lovely theory that members of our audience are responsible for. So here was this was an analysis of the transmural variation of some popular strain components, including fiber shortening, the first and second and third eigen values of the strain tensor, the circumferential and longitudinal shortening, the radial and plus fiber shortening. So the longitudinal shortening is also surprisingly uniform transmural, but the best one is really the fiber shortening as a percent of its mean value. But to embellish that, we can actually calculate the transmural variation of the principal shortening directions. So here's that same Helix angle code applied to the principal shortening directions. And here's the summary slide that I really like. Here we measure the angle between the fiber and the direction of maximum shortening. Okay? So this was directly from the work of the question was what is that angle? And what we find is that at the epicardial surface, the direction of maximum shortening is parallel to the fiber. And as the fiber angle basically swings around 180 degrees from epicardium to endocardium. It goes from vertical to vertical. But the direction of principal shortening goes from vertical to horizontal. So in the endocardium, the fiber is contracting, if you like, as little as possible. At the outer wall, it's contracting as much as possible. And it is that change in angle which is responsible for the ability to have a constant fiber shortening across a wall that has a kind of 0.2 strain epicardial and a 0.4 strain endocardial. Okay? So, and furthermore, the number, if you look at the amount of tissue volume that is doing, in which there is any possible angle between 0 and 90 degrees, it equipartitions. You have the same partial volume of tissue in every angular bin between 0 and 90 degrees. And to me, that kind of deep repartition speaks of a very strong mechanical optimization going on, that it's like you're filling, you're pouring water into a container and it's seeking its own level. It's a lowest energy constraint that wants to put an equal angle in every bin. Too far? Okay, there you go. But look, it's, you know, the line. Let's look at strain and hypokinesis in HCM. A nice correlation can be shown. Here, for example, let's see, which one is which? Disarray is measured by the anisotropy of the diffusion tensor. So we have disarray here and here. This is just the fiber arc. This image is just fiber arc. Okay, here, let's start. Magnitude image, helix angle image, trouble, trouble. Anisotropy images, normal, a mess, sheet strain, lots of it, uh-oh. And this is that same heart that we saw before. You see the bands now, the buckling that I called attention to earlier? But you see trouble. And so you see that this buckling is indeed occurring in which fiber disarray is as bad as possible. So possible to correlate intramural strain with stiffness. Yes?
What's the measure of disarray?
The standard deviation of the eigenvalues of the diffusion tensor. So if they have a high standard deviation, if they're spread out, if you have a big gap between the lowest and highest eigenvalue, then that's that's high anisotropy, lesser gap, more spherical tensor, disarray, intravoxel, random stuff. So, let's see all this. What is that? So, myocardial sheaths. Where are we headed with this? Yeah, well, so we've been talking a little bit about what the effect of tissue deformation is on diffusion. And the situation that I described before, considering the model of dropping dye into a continuum of jello, is the simplest case where you have a continuum and a linear continuum at that. But of course, the myocardium isn't. And you started to think about what happens if you have diffusion, if you have these sheets sliding past each other. The thing that I was curious to get would be a direct observation of sheet shear. Now, what does that mean? That's not just to say linear shear that happens to be aligned with the sheet direction, but actual evidence that the sheets are sliding over one another. This is what I started to think about. And I started to model what the diffusion would look like as a function of the size of the sheets. And what you see is that it's the diffusion kind of hops from one sheet to another and makes kind of footprints. I mean, it's as if you've stepped in paint and the paint is going splat, splat, splat as it jumps from one sheet to another across this continuous cleavage plane. And this was the image that gave me trouble, because this thing, to try to look at this effect, to try to measure this effect, it's plain that this image, that this effect is not measurable with a tensor. And it was really this image more than anything that got me to abandon the tensor model. The tensor model simply has 2 to 3 degrees of freedom to describe this thing. But moreover, here is a clear model case in which the diffusion is nothing like a Gaussian. So at this point you start to say, you spend hours saying, which tensor is it, until you realize it's no tensor. So what to do? Well, what to do is just take a picture of that distribution. Never mind whether it's a tensor, just take a picture of the spread of diffusion. And so, for example, what you end up with is a picture of the probability density function of diffusion in any particular direction and to any particular distance. If, for example, you had crossing fibers like this, then you would see a thing like this. This approach turns out to be the solution to the major problem of using diffusion in the brain. The brain is absolutely chock full of crossing fibers. In fact, the whole body is chock full of crossing fibers once you look for them. So instead of taking diffusion in 7 directions, you take diffusion in 500 directions. This takes many donuts. and you get images such as this. Where here, for example, coronal brain image ponds, you have this region shows a crossing of the cerebellar peduncular fibers with the corticospinal fibers. The tensors are unrevealing and inaccurate in this area. But instead, we get these diffusion spectra in which each little lobe of the ants looks represents a separate fiber population. And from this, we can, of course, do tractography if we have three-dimensional data. So you just connect the dots in the ordinary way. This is that same data set. This is that same, you know, vertical fibers and horizontal fibers. That's it. So so that's what you're looking at before. This is, for example, a monkey brain. The monkey brain is this big, and it's isolated and soaked in whatever, the fombolin oil and imaged overnight. And this is one slice of the monkey data. This is about 1% of the total data set. This data, these data are like no other data because they've got 5 million fibers. And you go digging and digging, and these are just the fibers that end and have one terminus on one slice of the data set, 1% of the data. And this is too much to see at once. You've got to go fishing inside this thing in order to make any sense of it anatomically. Yes?
Could you comment a little bit on how photography is that in the sense that when you do have a camera, people are doing the
the algorithm is the simplest one we can think of. What it does is it extends a line, and when it gets to the next voxel, it chooses the direction closest to its incoming direction and continues if that next direction results in a curvature less than a half a radian per voxel. The choice of a half a radian per voxel is conditioned by the fact that if you had more than that, then the diffusion would be spread out and you wouldn't have a well-collimated maximum. Another defense of the method is that it's the stupidest possible method. And that's very important, because if the method is doing something clever, you'll never know what it means.
How does it manage to control the fiber crossing problem?
You have two directions at each point. So you have those little, you take that little fuzz ball with all the little bumps on it, you identify the maxima. So you then get a polyvector. You get a field that has five vectors per point. And you see the entire volume, and you extend the line, and you get to the next voxel. If it has five vectors to choose from, it picks the closest one, and if the turning angle is not excessive, the line grows, and if the turning angle is excessive, the line stops. And that's what you do. Yeah, Matt?
Going back to your parts for a minute, in the art term, did you have an opportunity to examine the relationship of the diffusion disarray you showed to the areas of fibrosis spread by the terrain enhancement?
No. No. That would certainly work too, I agree. That would be very interesting.
What do diffusion properties look like in implant treatment?
They're very poorly imaged. You basically lose the signal. It's a T2-weighted study, and I think that the real infarct scar is virtually invisible. Pragmatically, it's invisible in a diffusion-weighted image. So what you may see in an infarct will be the rearrangement of fiber orientation surrounding the infarct, but the infarct itself may not show anything. I'll show you a mouse infarct in what follows. So anyway, here, this is just digging inside that data set. This is the classic circuit of the limbic pathway, including the cingulum bundle up here, and the hippocampus, and this is the fornix, and so on. Now here, I'll just show this image. Here we put a seed region in the motor cortex, and you see that from one region, you actually have many different populations of fibers coming out, all because you can see crossing fibers. In this instance, we see the effect of development. This is a 17-day-old rabbit, and this is a 96-day-old rabbit. And look at this anterior commissure that's just barely visible here and really grows in over here. I'm just throwing these up to suggest some of the range of phenomena that can be appreciated with this tractography. Here at disarray in the cerebral cortex, this is a polymicrogyria specimen removed surgically and treated with intractable epilepsy compared with normal cortex, and you see immediately the disorganization. Now, for imaging the cortex itself, some special things were done. The cortex mostly consists of, the cerebral cortex mostly consists of radial structure, but there are some horizontal fibers whose structure is poorly understood. What
are you recording in this picture of what?
That, which one? This one?
Yes.
That's a good question. That's human cortex.
Is that?
That's microscopy.
Why is that?
What?
What is a...
This is a myelin stain.
Okay.
There's something very fishy going on here. What that is, the question is, what does the diffusion detect? Which cellular component does the diffusion detect? And the answer is, nobody really knows. What it detects is anything with any structure whose correlation function has a particular orientation, which could even be, you see these dots here? I mean, this is an example of a cerebral mini-colon.
50% chance.
What?
50% chance of
mirror. In this instance, yes. This one is new to me.
25%.
Bill Gates will receive a letter. That's right. The question is, which components here are responsible for the diffusion anisotropy? And it's both the fiber components and the cell bodies whose alignment is radial. So what one sees in the cerebral cortex is a strong signal pointing in the radial direction and a highly confusing and disorderly signal in the horizontal directions. So we needed a way to enhance the coherence of this horizontal signal. What we wanted was a way to tell one cortical region from another. We wanted a signal that would differentiate one cortical zone from another. This radial architecture is pervasive. So obviously it's useless in telling one cortical region apart from another one. So the hypothesis was, well, maybe the horizontal signal will show interregional variation. But the raw horizontal signal is too big of a mess. It doesn't show enough coherence to be a signal. It's more like noise. Plan B. Look for planar structure. Now, detecting planes is a less restrictive algebraic constraint than detecting a line. It's two-dimensional instead of one-dimensional. So it's more likely that you're going to catch something. And when you soften your order parameter from mnemic to smectic, if you like, from linear to planar, all of a sudden a coherent spatial order emerges. Something going on inside the cortex which is not random. And so now the question is how to organize data of this kind. So you look and you say, okay, I think it might be anatomic. What can I do to decide? Well, integrate it. So do path integrals through this plane field. As you know, plane fields are not integrable in general. However, if you limit yourself to the direction parallel to the cortical surface, you can define integrals. And they are spatially coherent. And they do very beautiful things. So that's how you get the planes. Here, for example, this is a monkey cortex. And you start to look at this thing, and you say, here's the image of the fibers across the monkey cortex. And the longer you look at it, compare in relation to the cytoarchitectonic map, the more correspondences you see. And there's really kind of no stopping. Look at this temporal area here compared with this area. This is as a starting place for something that's clearly non-random and that's correlating. Look at this superior temporal area here. Look at the V1, V2 boundary here. This brain is sort of rotated towards us, so V1 is kind of around the back. The contrast between generally the motor areas here and the sensory areas more posteriorly at the central sulcus shows a sharp contrast boundary. When one looks across fields, one sees a very suspicious and intriguing increase in architectural complexity from rabbit to bush baby to little marmoset monkey up to macaque monkey. One sees the elaboration. So I'm rather optimistic that this horizontal and cortical contrast will provide a way to non-invasively differentiate cortical areas. This falls in the tradition of cytoarchitectonics and then myeloarchitectonics, which is the architectonics that comes from white matter. So what's this got to do? It's just, so you can also lose other things besides your other fibers. We just heard about some attempts to look at the tongue. This is a cow tongue. And this is the fiber architecture in a cow tongue. And it's a lovely fiber crossing fan. You've got vertical fibers running through in a fan in the comprising the genioglossus muscle. And these blue fibers that are perpendicular to the board are crossing. And so the protrusion of the tongue is just like systole. In systole, you've got crossing fibers, and they make the wall thick. And in the tongue, you have crossing radial and crossing vertical and transverse fibers, and they contract simultaneously, and the tongue goes, And more the point, it goes backwards, and that's how you swallow. Now, here's the esophagus. You really went to the butcher shop and spent a nice afternoon. This is the gastroesophageal junction that many of you prilosec aficionados may know. So, and you have the nice spiral architecture in the esophagus and the strap muscles. But the esophagus is really interesting. Check this out. So this is the esophagus. So you really have two spiral populations, left-handed and right-handed spirals. Would anyone want to venture a guess as to the spatial disposition of the left-handed compared with the right-handed spirals? Any takers? Inside, outside, where are they? You would never believe it in a million years. They cross. One orientation is anterior and the other orientation is posterior, and they intersect along two zippers located laterally. Go figure. So crossing helices. You can see why the thing would want to have more than one helix angle. If the thing only had a single helix angle, you can see that the thing would want to contract in a spiral way. It would have a lot of torsion as it contracted, and that would be a problem. I guess except for sharks, who I guess work that way. Sharks have a spiral esophageal sphincter anyway. So you want to have two of them to counter rotate the thing. But why they should be crisscrossed like this, I have no idea. So, heart. Cow heart. So, fiber architecture of the cow heart. This is the more superficial fibers. Let's see, this is just, they always cut the hearts open in America. You can't get a cow heart that hasn't been sliced. Look at the worms. And the FDA will shut them down if so much as a single heart escapes unsliced. I'm sorry, USDA. US, this is what my thing means. USDA. Fibers of inner and outer walls. So the more superficial fibers in blue on the left and the more mid-wall fibers on the right. Now here we have post-infarct hearts. There was a transient ischemia, and in the second specimen, the one on the bottom, these are rat hearts that were subjected to ischemic insult lasting 15 minutes. And the one on the bottom, the fibers were fucking horizontal. So it would really be nice to design an experiment that would look at this and demonstrate that there really is a change from its pre-injury condition. It's a known effect, but it would be great to see the whole thing three-dimensional. This is some work being done by Judy Hungen at the Mass General, who's injecting polymer into the myocardium to stabilize the papillary muscle insertion following infarction. And so there's this ball of jello over here that's it's like chewing gum that's inserted. And the question on the part of the NIH reviewers was, is this disrupting fiber architecture remote from the location of the polymer infiltration? And the strain image shows, excuse me, the fusion image shows that no, it isn't. You've really got a remarkably thin rim of distorted fiber architecture just adjacent to this thing. But one radius away, there's nothing. Now, of course, the next question is that good news or bad news? Because it means that you have a very high concentration of static deformation right next to this thing. Could that be an arrhythmogenic concern? But in any case, it was nice that the diffusion imaging was able to solve this structural question. Well, here's an infarct. This is the same part, just in two different orientations with the helix angle code. And to answer your question now, so this is a rat heart. and there's basically a huge hole, and there's some preservation of more endocardial, and you get some signal from the endocardial fibers, at least, this red stuff that goes through. But you see that as Alistair was saying earlier, in the rat model, the infarct is pretty transmural from the get-go, and so we get this huge defect. A second analysis of this data was an attempt to measure the anisotropy along the fibers. You have this three-dimensional diffusion distribution. You can say, is the diffusion in the fiber direction very collimated, or is it a little bit more spread out? And that's what color code indicates in this case. Now, there are some areas adjacent to the infarct in which there has been an obvious change in the anisotropy of diffusion compared with unaffected regions. But what's really striking, and unfortunately this image doesn't show it brilliantly, is that the entire RV is composed, has a different fiber anisotropy than the LV. You know, these fibers that go both the septal and free wall portion of the RV, they're all kind of red. And it's really like the sleeve of different anisotropy along the fibers. There's some structural contrast there, perhaps a relatively more loosely woven fiber architecture in the inner half of the RV myocardium. But a very striking finding. Well, this is essentially the last piece of data I'd like to show you. So remember that business with the cortex where we looked perpendicular to the fibers, we said, okay, there's the radial fibers, we're going to look perpendicular to them. Well, we did the same thing in the myocardium. We said, let's look perpendicular to the main fiber direction for the sheets. Now, the funny thing about the sheets, what's the trouble with looking at sheets with tensors? As Alistair showed, as many people have commented, there's more than one sheet direction per point. It's not true. Not only are they not an integrable plane field, they're not even one plane field, they're some kind of multiple plane field. Like maybe they're an accordion or an egg crate kind of configuration. And it was intensely frustrating to me that nobody had ever been able to come up with a credible global picture of what the sheets look like. And somebody says, here's a phone book. Okay, here are the pages of the book, and here's where they're bound. Here's a picture of a bunch of sheets. But how the sheets are disposed globally in the myocardium seemed to me a relatively unsolved problem. How they merge.
We did the Kevin Kostka, Andrew McCulloch, and we were making this sheet. It's a drawing in the paper. It's a magazine drawing for the book.
I think that this is highly consistent. I know that image, and I think that this is perhaps another image of the same thing. Here we tracked the multiple sheet directions because we can deal with multiple directions per point, and we put fibers down to them. And what we get is two shifted cones. You have one cone, you have the red stuff, and then the green stuff is shifted relative to the red stuff. So it's again shifted. It's two cylinders, but they're like this, side by side, not one inside the other, but one next to the other. And I think that this picture of the left-handed versus the right-handed sheets, you have some sheets that are left-handed, some that are right-handed, and the idea of intersecting cylinders may, to me, is suggestive of what's going on. That you have displaced intersecting cylinders comprising the two domains. At least that's what this data suggests. So I don't know if that's how consistent that is, but it is a global picture of sheet of the helix angle or myocardial angle of the sheets, which suggests two domains which are displaced intersecting cylinders. And I had to stare at this a long time, and I had to see the esophagus picture first before I would, to believe that kind of weird construction might be a possible solution. But I kind of think so.
If you put them under the microscope, then you very clever. But if you put them under the microscope,
to me it's hopeless. There's no, you put them under the microscope, but the analysis just gets away from it. With due respect, it's really hard. I mean, it's just a very hard problem. So anyway, like I said, I do have a little bit more data. So the last question was, does the, you know, can we measure sheet motion? Well, when we look at these probability density functions over time in the cardiac cycle, they really change shape. And when I say they, how do you know they really change shape? Well, okay, if you measure the multivariate kurtosis excess of this distribution is independent of linear transformation. If you take a shape and you subject it to any linear matrix, its multivariate kurtosis is independent of linear scaling of any kind. So therefore, if you measure the multivariate kurtosis and see it change, then you know the shape really had to change. It didn't just stretch or scale. And so we see this across the myocardium in the diffusion pattern over time, suggesting a signature, a marker of actual rearrangement inside the tissue. Anyway, to conclude, this talk presents a number of methods for converting biological questions into specific NMR contrast mechanisms. The idea is not so much to do image processing as it is to build the physiological biologic question into a particular NMR contrast mechanism